Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We're continuing with the fourth talk on dependent origination from this collection of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, volume 3 of the anthology. And these are all talks from the winter retreat of 1988. So we're just nearly at the end of this this fourth talk on dependent origination, and this one's called Feeling Conditions Desire. Well, the first thing I should mention was that sutta quotation I referred to yesterday. It was the one about rooted in interest are all things, Chandamula. That was a Book of the Tens, sutta number 58. It wasn't 63, that was a complete fantasy. So Book of the Tens, sutta number 58, if you're interested to follow that one up. So Lumpur had just been talking about neutral feeling and how space is neither attractive nor unattractive. So contemplate in this way. What is desire? When you're feeling pain in your body, if you reflect on the actual physical sensation of pain, you become aware of adding the desire to get rid of it to that physical sensation. Notice the actual sensation that you have in the body and the aversion to it, the desire to get rid of the pain. Notice that the breath doesn't arouse desire. Maybe you have a desire to concentrate your mind to become one who has samadhi or something like that. I want to become a person who can attain jhana. But the actual breathing is neither attractive, interesting, nor unattractive. For most people, the idea of attaining jhana, becoming somebody who can realize jhana, is attractive. So we can go about doing anapanasati with that desire. Or maybe you have a distracted mind. The mind wanders, doesn't do what you want. You want it concentrated on the breath, but every time you start, it wanders off. So you want to get rid of the distracted mind. You want to become someone who has a composed and concentrated mind, not someone who has a wandering, distracted mind. That's vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of the wandering mind, the distracted mind, by becoming somebody who has a concentrated mind and can attain jhana. This is a way of reflecting on desire. Desire for sense pleasure, desire to become, desire to get rid of. If we really contemplate and know Vedana exactly through vijja, through mindfulness and wisdom, then we don't create desire. There's still the pleasure, the pain, the neither pleasant nor painful, but things are as they are. This is the suchness, tatata, the way things are. It's the Dhamma, the truth. There's no suffering when things are as they are. Suffering is a result of desire grasping becoming, tanha upadana bhava. From there, the sequence of paticca samuppada goes on to birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Jati, jara, maranang, soka, parideva, dukkha, dominasa, upayasa. The whole sequence of misery follows on from tanha upadana bhava. So, contemplate this theme of paticca samuppada during this retreat. The desire to get rid of desire is still a trap of the mind. Contemplation is not getting rid of, but understanding. This is the way of knowing, of vijja rather than avijja. So these are simple but very essential principles, and particularly the working with pain, and the image and simile of the two arrows, something that I've referred to over and over again, and it's really That's the crucial difference to notice, because when we talk about the ending of suffering, it's not about the ending of pain. So when we talk about dukkha nirodha, the ending of suffering in terms of the Four Noble Truths, that's all about the second arrow. That's all about what the mind adds. You can have and you probably noticed here in the meditation hall or wherever you happen to be sitting, we can have a pain in our body, in our knees or our back or wherever it might be, in our shoulders or our neck. And the pain is still painful, but the mind can be completely at peace with it. You're not pretending it's pleasant. You're not switching off from it, so distracting the mind and putting the attention somewhere else altogether. You feel that painful feeling, but it's absolutely not a problem. You're not just being stupid with it. You can also, within that awareness of it, there can be the intuitive wisdom related to what the limits of the body are, and that you know, well, my knee has just started aching. It'll probably be a few minutes before this joint is really under serious pressure, or there's any kind of danger of permanent damage. Right now is uncomfortable, and so you can bring attention right to that and know that feeling just as it is. And it's kind of amazing and fascinating how, yes, it's painful, but it's absolutely not a problem. When the attitude is really clear, really open with respect to that, you're not pretending that you like it. You're not saying, oh, this is sweet and how wonderful, oh, great, how marvelous. But rather, it's a genuine, open-hearted acceptance that here it is. It's exactly like this. So the mind's not negotiating with it, not trying to get away from it, not complaining that it's there or thinking that it shouldn't be that way or waiting for it to be over even. It's just, here it is. So there's painfulness, but there's a great peace with it, a great spaciousness and ease with it. You're not trying to get rid of it. And so that that skill is incredibly important, because it can be learned working with physical pain, but it also works with emotional pain. So you can have feelings of regret, feelings of fear, feelings of say depression or self-criticism, feelings of anger, feelings of jealousy, all kinds of painful emotional states. And to know those and to say, you know, this is what jealousy feels like, or this is what anger feels like, or this is the feeling of regret or grief, sadness. It's like this. This is the I got it all completely wrong, and I made a terrible mess of the whole thing. Feeling. That's what this is. You're not pretending that there aren't lessons to learn from that. You're not trying to get away from it, but it's received completely, and it's mysterious, because even as it's agonizingly painful, there's this realization in the heart, this is absolutely okay. When Lumpur Sumedho first started to come and teach in the UK in the late 70s, when he talked about metta meditation, then he would use the kind of terminology of loving kindness meditation and may all beings be happy and so forth. But he noticed that people were really put off by the instructions that were so classical wording of instructions around metta bhavana, and that he realized in talking with people and hearing people's questions that people were really put off by the idea of metta because it seemed to be a kind of sentimentality or trying to make yourself sort of cheerful and sweet and liking everything. And the other morning I was chatting with him and he was talking about this a character in American children's stories called Pollyanna. I've never read any Pollyanna books myself, but apparently when you're growing up in America in the 30s and 40s, and there were these stories of this little girl, Pollyanna, who was sort of ever so sweet and ever so nice and ever so cheerful at all times. And so when he was teaching or describing metta practice, then he realized it could come across as this kind of Pollyanna-ish, if such a word exists, a kind of superficial, kind of sentimental sweetness, trying to think pink, as he would also put it. and that that was really off-putting. It was more irritating and off-putting to people. So he quite deliberately changed the wording in those very early years. So when I showed up here in England at the end of 79, already by then, when he talked about metta practice, he used the phrase not dwelling in aversion as a way of expressing loving kindness. So that it's rather than trying, because he would see it came across as metta is trying to make yourself like everything. But he realized, no, that's not what metta is at all. It's the heart that is open to things. It's not trying to make the bitter sweet or the painful pleasant. It's that open-hearted quality that does not finding fault, not contending against the painful or the unwanted or the difficult, the challenging. So he quite deliberately changed the wording of how he talked about it, and then that was much more understandable and workable for people. Not dwelling in aversion, which is, and then when he talked about it, he realized that you can love, the way we use the word love in English is that it tends to come across as meaning that you're trying to like everything. And he realized, no, you can love something without liking it. you can be kind towards that which is totally unlovable. Something can be quite disgusting or painful or offensive, but you can still be kind towards it. You don't have to hate it or feel or dwell in negativity towards that. So that is a very significant principle that he established at that time. And I feel that when we are talking about the two arrows, that it's that open-heartedness and dealing with painful physical sensations or painful emotional states, that it's that having metta, having that radical acceptance for those physical sensations or those emotional states, that's the way that the second arrow is avoided, and that it's when the mind is either trying to switch off and get distracted, or to suppress painful feeling, or is resenting it, getting trying to negotiate with it, blaming and criticizing, contending against painful or physically or emotionally painful states. That's when the second arrow is striking. So that the whole teaching on the Four Noble Truths, it's not about the ending of pain, but ending of that struggling and resenting, that negotiating, that second arrow. That's what it's all about. Any questions? So that's the end of that particular Dhamma talk. So any questions, thoughts? Anagarika Evgenia, please.
I wonder, it seems to be a difference between when something painful arises and you accepting it. It could be two cases. One is that...
It could be what?
Two different things, as I see. One is something arising just because of natural causes and you can accept it, but another one is because you've been stupid and it's consequences of your actions. So basically you see that because you did something earlier, now you have this painful emotional or physical feeling. And it seems that a response should be or is different. Whether one is just natural and you can just relax, accept and see and understand how nature works, but another one is like this pain is quite useful to really understand like this is connected mm-hmm. with your previous actions. And I assume that like the taste of acceptance is quite different, like these two things.
I think that's a good point. If there's really nothing that no action that you've taken is said to be a cause of what you're experiencing, but just it's happened because you're alive, then there's a very straightforward. It's much more straightforward and plain, but still the challenge is to. And not let the mind go into blaming and criticizing, and oh, if only I hadn't things hadn't taken shape this way, or if only I didn't have the kind of physiology that I have, then I wouldn't have these headaches or whatever. So it can be more straightforward. But the other kind of suffering where you see it's the result of some action that you've taken, you've got too enthusiastic with your yoga practice and you've wrenched your knee so that now you can't sit on the floor because of the damage you caused, then looking at the causes and learning from the causes is an important part of it. So that, you know, I would say that it's right. It's a slightly different approach. But either way, it's really good to bring that quality of reflective wisdom to that. So even if there's nothing that you've done, apparently, to make that painful feeling be there, still, moment by moment, it's up to this mind, this heart, to not make a problem out of it, to be really open to that, not to be feeding it or making anything out of it, not to be creating a sense of ownership around it. So there's still a working with it, even if there's a kind of unavoidable cause for it. You know, moment by moment, the challenge is to not see it in terms of, you know, my pain or my problem or when's this going to be over, those kind of things. So it's still a challenge in that way. And the reflective mind, that sense of looking at what the attitude is and then letting that wisdom and mindfulness help the attitude to be adjusted moment by moment is very, very helpful. If you can see there's a direct cause, then yesterday I was talking about equanimity, so that the way that upekkha, serenity, is developed is classically around the contemplation on cause and effect, which is essentially helping it not to be seen in personal terms. So that this is the cause, this is the effect. If a human being gets over-enthusiastic with their yoga practice, then wrenched knees are often the result. This is the cause, this is the effect. So it's seen in terms of a natural order rather than, oh, I'm so stupid, how could I have done that? You know, they warned me that was going to happen, and I'm a terrible idiot, and creating a lot of self around it. So equanimity, upekkha, that even-mindedness, is a shift from seeing things in terms of self-view to seeing things in terms of nature, and particularly around cause and effect. So it's kind of close to the development of insight and wisdom in that way. But if you watch what happens when you say, well, this is the cause, this is the effect, oh, there's a kind of balancing that happens. Like, oh, well, how could it be otherwise? You know, if you don't put on a jacket and you go out for a walk and then you realize, oh, it's a lot windier than I thought, then you're walking outside, it's a strong wind, so now you feel cold. The cause is walking out without a jacket. The effect is brrr. Cause, effect. Okay. So the mind just says, well, duh, you know, why are you surprised? Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. It's just the skin is sensitive. The wind is cold. You didn't put a jacket on. So there's this shivery feeling. That's the cause. That's the effect. End of story. And so even though it's still cold, there's an evenness, there's a balance in the heart, seeing how it's just the functioning of nature that's at work. And it just doesn't see things in such a personal way. So then that helps that quality of centeredness or even-mindedness in relationship to that. Any other thoughts, questions? So the next talk, Dependent Origination number 5, is called Letting Go of Desire. So this is the last of this particular little series. The arising of dukkha is due to the grasping of desires. And the insight is that there is this origin or arising, and that desire should be let go of. So the Pali in that is pahatabanti. Should be let go of. This is the second noble truth. It is the insight knowledge of letting go. Some people think that all I teach is whatever happens, let go. But the teaching involves a real investigation of suffering. Insight into letting go occurs through that understanding. So letting go does not come from a desire to get rid of suffering. That's not letting go. Vibhava tanha, or the desire to get rid of, is quite subtle. But wanting to get rid of our defilements is another kind of desire. Letting go is not a getting rid of or putting down or with any aversion. Letting go means being able to be with what is displeasing without dwelling in aversion. So that's the Lumpur's using that phrase here. Without dwelling in aversion, because aversion is an attachment. If you have a lot of aversion, you'll still be attached. Fear, aversion, all this is grasping and clinging. Dispassion is acceptance and awareness of things as they are, not creating anything. Letting go of the aversion to what is ugly or unpleasant. So, letting go, quote-unquote, is not a trick phrase coined as a way of dismissing things, but a deep insight into the nature of things. Letting go is therefore being able to bear with something unpleasant and not be caught up in anger and aversion. Dispassion is not depression. So, and that's... I think it's an easy mistake to make when, and Lumpur does talk a lot about letting go, and it can be, mistaken for, or can drift into a kind of nihilistic, just get rid of it, or a kind of undercover aversion, or a thinly disguised desire to get rid of. But in a way, letting go, as he says, it has to be done through understanding. In a way, it's part of it is the letting go. It depends on the insight that nothing can really be owned anyway. That the mind is trying to hold on to a sensation or a thought or a sound or a shape or a mood. It can't really own it. So there's no thing that can really be owned, and no thing that can really do any owning. So in a way, it's not really letting go because you. There isn't anybody that can own anything, and things can't be held onto anyway. It's like, can you own a waterfall? But you can't hold the water in your hand. The water's flowing through your fingers. You know, you can't own a sunbeam or a cloud. It's like, it's not ownable, can't be held onto. And so when we use terms like letting go, it's a figure of speech. It's a way of expressing oneself. But it's not like there's a me who is the owner of this memory or this mood or this sensation. This is my leg and I own the pain in it. It belongs to me. That's when we talk about letting go, it's really sort of from that subjective impression. It's like a figure of speech, as if there was a thing that really solidly and permanently existed and it was really being held onto and owned by a being, and so that when we talk about letting go with wisdom, and also not getting rid of, it's seeing that this is not really ownable. There is no thing that can really be held onto, and no thing here that can really own it or hold it. Those are just impressions based upon a distorted perception of things, upon wrong view, not seeing things clearly. So that in a way it's more helpful to think in terms of non-grasping. Again, you might think, well, who is it that would be doing any grasping, and what is there to grasp anyway? But when Lumpur Sumedho would teach, similarly, Lumpur Cha often in the Dhamma talks, they would say that it's all to do with how the mind relates to its objects. And so we can talk about not grasping or letting go, but it's really the not picking things up with an attitude of this is mine or this is a thing that is real and solid. But when we talk about letting go, it's in a sense you're starting from the place where ignorance has already had its effect. There's already seems to be a me who is the owner of this pain or this memory or this plan or this desire or this fear. So the languaging of it is expressing that sort of having started from a place of ignorance and identification. So if there's vijja, if there's the establishment of clarity, that there is that real ground of the practice, vijja as the sort of zero point, the basis of a practice, then it's recognized from the get-go, from the beginning, that there isn't anyone that can own anything, there's no thing to be owned, and so there isn't anything that's grasped or identified with that needs to be let go of. But when we talk about letting go, then it's based on the understanding that ignorance has already had its effect, and there seems to be a me who's the owner of this feeling, this attitude, this mind state, and this mood, and so on. So that we can, I think, and I feel it's helpful to be using that kind of method when you find that, say, during the course of the day and meditation, the sense of the mind clinging onto something, you can use those kinds of reflection to support that insight. Who is there to own anything and what is there to be owned? And so I've used that kind of reflection a lot. Who does this pain belong to? Is there an owner? What is it that does any owning, and what is the thing that's being owned? And when that kind of reflection or investigation is applied, then right there, there's a relaxation in the jitta, there's a spaciousness. And so the letting go is not me letting go of this thing, but in that light of wisdom, oh, there isn't anyone here to own anything, and there's no thing that can really be owned. So from, in a way, you can talk about it as letting go, but its basis is really that insight into not self, and also into emptiness, that the thing that is the mind has been trying to grasp has no substantiality, it's not solid or real permanent, and that which is trying to do the owning, so claiming this is mine, I am this, that is similarly, that's not self, there's no basis or core, no essence to that feeling of identity. So that makes sense? Speak up if not. You use the microphone.
Yes, thank you, Ajahn. I had a question about what you just said. This letting go, it seems like the kind of letting go that you're describing is maybe the highest kind of letting go, where one's seeing the emptiness, getting to understand the emptiness of the object one is attaching to, and maybe also oneself as a person or person trying to grasp something. But I wonder, compared to that, and those kinds of reflections that are behind that, the reflections on observing and reflecting on the danger of whatever one is attaching to or whatever habits one has, let's say, for example, unwholesome speech, maybe, you know, idle chatter or something. And on the one hand, one can maybe reflect on the emptiness of what's going on. But maybe on the other hand, reflecting on the consequences and all the bad effects that come from that. And similarly on the benefits of not doing it and all the good things that come from that. And then also feeling the pain, you know, just the dukkha of what comes from that. So, but mainly that looking, investigating the danger and of this activity, and then the benefits of the opposite activity, that seems to also lead to a kind of letting go, but it doesn't seem to be connected with emptiness so much. But do you feel like that's equally valid and useful as this maybe more subtle letting go through observing the impermanence and the non-self nature of what one is doing?
Those various different kinds of tools. It's rather like, what size chisel do you need? You know, what kind of work are you doing? Is it like some very, very fine groove that you need to make that's only a millimeter wide? Or do you need to carve out something that's sort of 10 millimeters wide? You know, what are you working on? And so that some tools are good for the more kind of rough, heavy work, and others are useful for the more refined and detailed work. It's like so many aspects of our practice. You know, for eating your meal, you use a spoon. For moving earth around, you use a shovel. It's like the different tools for different tasks. And so that the that kind of reflecting on, say, the unskillful speech, idle chatter, and so on, and that the effects of getting lost in that, and just to be able to look at, well, it was gratifying when I was doing that. There was the asada, that was enjoyable while I was doing that, and now here's the andinava, here's the regret, and I was stupid, and why did I say that? And, oh dear, I have to apologize for that one. That wasn't really true, that either. And so you look, oh, that was the gratification, that's the danger. And then, so that is a kind of letting go, but it's still like, I did that, I enjoyed that, now I am regretting that. So the feelings of self-view are still kind of solidly there, but it's still worthwhile recognizing this is the cause, this is the effect. Ow! So it's useful in that respect. It's at a somewhat more coarse level, but it's still very useful. It's like if you want to move a pile of earth, don't use a teaspoon, use a shovel. So that, and a lot of our practice is learning to use sort of tools appropriate to the tasks of the situation and to be seeing what works and what's beneficial, what's helpful for us. And so that, because if you're always trying to work on a super refined level, sometimes it's just ridiculous. It's just not effective, because like trying to move a pile of earth with a teaspoon, it's like, no, it's not appropriate to the task. That in the midst of activity, say if you are the work monk and you're trying to organize the kind of day's activities with 15 or 20 people at the work meeting, and then you're trying to notice the emptiness of all of the sounds in the, people are saying, well, what should I do? And you told me that, you told me something different yesterday. And it's not fit, that kind of level of refinement is not suitable to running a work meeting. You have to operate at a more kind of coarse level, so that sort of just take care of the meeting, do what you can to share the duties out appropriately, and then look at the resonances of that afterwards. And say, oh, I was a bit short, tempered when I spoke to that monk, and I was unmindful when I cracked that joke, and that doesn't feel very good to me now. So it's in a kind of context of self-view, and I remember this, and that was helpful, that was unhelpful, that wasn't quite true, and so on. But that's appropriate to the situation. So it's weighing up what's appropriate, the time, the place, the situation. Who you're with, are you sitting by yourself in the temple in silence or in your kuti, or are you in the middle of a work meeting? what's going on? Who are you with? So, like in the qualities of sapurisa, the seven qualities that I talk about quite often. So one of them is kalanyuta, knowing the right time. A parisanyuta, knowing the group that you're talking to, the group that you're with. The atanyuta, knowing your own character, all those kind of things. So it's a lot to do with mindfulness and awareness of the time, the place, the situation, what's appropriate, what's the right tool for the job. Okay, so to continue. How many of you dismiss and refuse to acknowledge the unpleasantness of the functions of your own bodies? There are certain functions of the human body that aren't beautiful, that we do not mention in polite society. We use all kinds of euphemisms, that means alternative words or ways of expressing. We use all kinds of euphemisms and ways of politely excusing ourselves at the appropriate moment, because we do not want the perception of ourselves to be connected with those functions. We want our presence or image to be connected with something pleasing, interesting, or attractive. We want our photograph taken with flowers in an attractive setting, not on the toilet. We want to disguise the natural processes of life, cover up the wrinkles, dye the hair, do everything to make ourselves look younger, because aging is not attractive. As we grow older, we lose what is beautiful and attractive. Our reflection is to be really aware of sickness and death, that which is attractive and unattractive. The way things are in this realm of sensory consciousness, being an entity with sense organs which contact objects, they may be anything from the most beautiful and pleasing to the most hideous and ugly. We experience feelings. Feeling, Vedana, entails the alternatives of the pleasant, the painful, and the neutral. This applies to all the senses, taste, touch, sight, hearing, smell, and thought. So, Vedana, I use that particular word, that khanda, as the concept for all that attraction and repulsion. We are experiencing Vedana. We're aware of the pleasant, painful, beautiful, ugly, neutral, through the body or through what we hear, smell, taste, touch, or think. Even memories can be attractive. We can have memories that are pleasing, unpleasant, or neutral. And if we're heedless and operate from avijja, self-view, the unquestioned assumption that I am, the attractive, unattractive, and neutral, are interpreted with desire. I want the beautiful, I want the pleasant, I want to be happy and successful, I want to be praised, I want to be appreciated, I want to be loved, I don't want to be persecuted, unhappy, sick, looked down upon, or criticized. I don't want ugly things around me. I don't want to look at the ugly, to be around the unpleasant. Consider the functions of our body. We all know that these functions are just a part of nature, but we don't want to think of them as being ours. I have to urinate, but I would not want to be known in history as Sumato the urinator. Sumato the abbot of Amaravati, that's all right. When I write my autobiography, it'll be filled with things like the fact that I was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, about how sensitive I was as a little child, innocent and pure, maybe a little mischievous now and then because I don't want to be seen as a Cupid doll. But in most biographies, the unpleasant functions of the body are just dismissed. We're not to go around thinking we should identify with these functions, but just to begin to notice the tendency not to want to be bothered with them or pay attention to them and observe a lot of what is part of our life, the way things are. In mindfulness, we open our minds to this, to the whole of life, which includes the beautiful, the ugly, the pleasing, the painful, and the neutral. So in our reflection on the Paticca-samuppada, we see it as connected to the second noble truth. So if I remember correctly, this was a long time ago, 1988 was 31 years ago, so it's quite a while back. But if I remember correctly, when we had a tape library here, cassette tapes, this tape used to be labeled Sumato the Urinator. I might be mistaken in my memory, but that was the most popular of the tapes in the tape library. In the library had the whole rack of cassette tapes, so people say Sumato the Urinator. So that was a compelling title for a Dhamma talk. So even though he didn't want to be known as Sumato the Urinator, he became part of the kind of local history just because of the way he uses it. And it's not the only time he uses it in this talk, actually. So, and I feel this is also interesting and in part of when the Buddha describes the sort of mindfulness of the body in the Sutta teachings, then frequently it's sitting, standing, walking, lying down, breathing, eating, urinating, defecating. It's all sort of there in the same form of expression, sort of very matter of fact and ordinary aspects of our life, and so that that kind of editing that goes on within us that sort of doesn't want to accept or acknowledge those body functions, then it's in a way important to include those or to bring them into our field of attention. You also notice how if you read stories or watching movies. It's extremely rare for someone in a story, in a novel, to mention that the protagonist sort of got up and went to the bathroom and came out again. You know, they went to the bathroom, urinated, and came out. It never happens. It's never part of the plot. Very, very rare that people sort of will mention body functions of that nature just as part of the narrative. I think James Joyce was famous for being one of the very first people to do that in Ulysses back in 1922. But it's very rare, even just eating food. You know that you can read a 500-page novel, and nobody ever eats anything the whole time. Nobody ever breathes in or breathes out for the, you know, 500 pages of the whole story. It's like no one or goes to sleep. You know, they can just sort of, the whole story carries on with these sort of interesting, colorful events, eating, sleeping, defecating, urinating. It's not part of the story, but it is part of our story every day. Breathing in, breathing out. If you stop that for 5 minutes, the game is over. You know, our life comes to an end. So a lot of the development of mindfulness is around those simple body functions: sitting, standing, walking, lying down, you know, eating, breathing, defecating, urinating, feeling warm, feeling cold, and feeling hungry, feeling full. And the encouragement of the teachings is, you know, pay attention to that. Don't dismiss that or brush it aside, but rather be aware of these particular aspects of our everyday experience. That just because it's ordinary or it's familiar doesn't mean to say that it's not of value or of significance. Any thoughts, questions?
Yeah, just one, you know, one comment along those same lines is that Longpoor Liam usually finds a way to mention toilets in most of his Dhamma talks. So, for example, when I've been there mostly when there's huge groups, but he will mention how many toilets it takes to look after such a large group, and I mean he's well aware of it because he had to build them all. But that's it's obviously intentional, and a characteristic of his teachings.
Yeah, I haven't spent that much time around Longpoor Liam, but when you say that, it's like, that's right. And when we were putting together the collected teachings of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Jayasaro absolutely insisted, there was a talk that was called Toilets on the Path, and he absolutely insisted that be included in the collection. There was a few people, it's a bit kind of a bit rough, or not so sort of pleasing for the discerning reader. And he said that has to go in, absolutely determined for that. No negotiation around that one. It was one of the Western monks had not made it to the toilet in time and had an explosion on the path on the way to the outhouse, and Longpo Cha was not going to let that pass by, and was definitely addressed as a community issue. Yeah, who exploded? You can find it in the Ajahn Chah collected teachings. Actually, I think there's the audio version is now. Ajahn Siripanyo was doing the audio version, reading it. The biography of Longpo Cha, that's also available along with the collected teachings. So. I suspect Ajahn Jayasaro included it in the biography as well as in the collected teaching set as well. So to continue. This is where the sequence Tanha Upadana Bhava is most helpful as a means of investigating grasping. Grasping in this sense can mean grasping because of attraction or because of aversion, trying to get rid of. Grasping with aversion is pushing away. Running away is upadana, as is trying to get hold of the beautiful and possess it and keep it. Seeking after the desirable, trying to get rid of the undesirable. So even though we think of grasping as trying to hang on to something that we feel is precious and good, also running away from things or that kind of rejection is also a way of grasping. The more we contemplate and investigate upadana, the more the insight arises. Desire should be let go of. In the Second Noble Truth, it's explained that when suffering arises, it should be let go of. And then, through the practice of letting go and the understanding of what letting go really is, we have the third insight into the Noble Truth. Desire has been let go of. We actually know letting go. It's not a theoretical letting go. It's not a rejection of anything. It's the actual insight. In discussing the Second Noble Truth, there are the statements. There is the origin of suffering. It should be let go of. And the third insight, it has been let go of. So this is what they call the three modes for each of the Four Noble Truths. So the first one is pariyatti, that's the study of it. So there is dukkha, or there is the origin of dukkha, there's the cessation of dukkha, there is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So that's the pariyatti, or the intellectual knowledge, the study of the condition. And then patipatti is the practice, what is the appropriate way of working with it. So dukkha is parinyayanti, it is to be apprehended or understood. The origin of dukkha, pahatabanti, it is to be let go of. And then Lumpur explains the other ones later on in this same section. And then the third of the three modes is pativeta. So pariyatti, patipatti, pativeta. So patipatti is practice. So the naming of the condition, the practice is appropriate to it, and then the result of that practice, pativeta, the liberation or the realization. So that's the three modes: pariyatti, patipatti, pativeta. Study, practice, and realization is the sort of three modes for each of the Four Noble Truths. It should be let go of, and the third insight, it has been let go of. So for the Second Noble Truth, pahatabanti, pahinanti, it has been let go of. And that is what the practice is all about, fulfilling those three. That applies to each of the Noble Truths. There is the statement, what to do about it, and then the result of that. The First Noble Truth, there is suffering. It should be understood, it has been understood. These are the three aspects of insight into the First Noble Truth. Second Noble Truth, there is the origin of suffering, samudaya, which is the grasping of desire. It should be let go of, it has been let go of. The Third Noble Truth, there is cessation, nirodha. It should be realized. And the third insight, it has been realized. So that's in Pali is sacchikata banti, is it should be realized. Sacchikatanti, it has been realized. The Fourth Noble Truth, there is the Eightfold Path, the way out of suffering. It should be developed. It has been developed. So bhavetabhanti, it should be developed. Bhavitanti, it has been developed. This is insight knowledge. When you think, what does an arahant know? It's this. He or she knows there is suffering. He knows suffering should be understood. He knows when suffering has been understood. He knows the origin of suffering. He knows it should be let go of, knows that it has been let go of, etc. These are the 12 insights. This is what we call arahantship, the knowledge of one who has those insights. Paticca-samuppada is a really close investigation of the whole process. It is grasping of the five khandhas that is the problem. The five khandhas are dhammas. They're to be studied and investigated. They are just the way they are. They are not a self. They are impermanent. And to know this is the way it is. And to know this is the way it is to know the Dhamma. And so the grasping of the conditioned world as a self is based on delusion or ignorance, avicca, the illusion of a self as being the five khandhas. And because of that, we live our lives based on ignorance. The volitional activities, sankhara, from that ignorance, interpret everything from I am, and from the grasping of desires. The result is jara marna, aging and death. If I grasp the body as self, I, quote-unquote, get old. My body is aging. It's sagging and wrinkly. And the belief that I'm getting old, because the body is getting old, is a kind of suffering. If there is no sense of self, there's no suffering. There's an appreciation of the body's aging. There's no feeling that there's anything wrong with the body getting old. That is what it's supposed to do. That is its nature. It's not me. It's not mine. And it's doing what it's supposed to do. Perfect, isn't it? I would be upset if I started getting younger. Eventually, I'd be back in nappies, and I'd have to go through everything again. That happens when you get older anyway, so the aging process sometimes involves nappies. So that is part of the aging system as well. The thought, I'm getting old, quote-unquote, isn't sorrowful. It's a conventional way of talking about the body. But if this is what I think I am the body, this is my body, then ignorance conditions sankhara and gives rise to many other problems. I'm getting old. I want to be young. I want to live a long life. Don't you call me an old man, you young whippersnapper. Why? Because of identifying with the body. And then I'm going to die. That's a morbid thing. Let's not even talk about death. Of course we're all going to die, but that's far away. When you're young, you think of death as so far away. Let's enjoy life. But when anyone we know dies, or we nearly die, death can be very frightening. And all that is from attachment to the identity, I am this body. So Lumpur was 54 when he gave this Dhamma talk, 1988. So that's 10 years younger than I am now. Am I the oldest person here? I might be the oldest person here. But still, yeah, I'm also getting sagging and wrinkly. That it's not just Lumpur Sumedho experiencing those things, but that's the way that things develop, and so much energy is burned in the human family in many countries all around the world of fighting the aging process, pretending it's not happening, and spending incredible amounts of time and energy and effort and emotional juice trying to stop the aging process. Not that we don't care about the body or want to look after our health and sort of do the best we can to maintain well-being, but it's an astonishing amount of human resources are spent on trying to stop the aging process, and that with a change of attitude and not being complacent or say insensitive, that just being able to have the kind of attitude that Lumpur is expressing here, like the thought, I'm getting old, isn't sorrowful. It's a conventional way of talking about the body. So if the body's not self, the body's getting old, but so. one doesn't have to be identified with that as everything of who and what you are. I realize there's also many, many dimensions to that. It's not just how you see yourself, it's how other people see you. And particularly, I know for people who are quite aged, the sense of not having any value, of not having a role to play, being someone who's becomes invisible or not a not contributing to society and so on and so forth, those kinds of loss can be really challenging. But again, if we reflect skillfully as the aging process progresses, then we are not making not building our sense of worth or value, or meaning around having a job or a function or being seen in a particular way or being admired or being complimented. But rather, we taking refuge in the reality of nature. And so that you're preparing your jitta, your heart, your mind for that process, so that as those changes come about and you do become less able to hear or move or to remember, to communicate, you're not expected to be in the world of work, or you're a retired senior monk or senior nun and you're no longer useful even within the monastery, not sort of busy doing stuff with all of the youngsters like you used to. But if you've prepared yourself skillfully, then it's joyful. It's like, oh, how delightful! I don't have to do that anymore. Don't have to be performing in those particular ways. It can be very kind of enjoyable, easeful, liberating. That you are not identified with those particular activities or those abilities, and so then it's quite restful, quite comfortable to be with those changes. I remember there was this very old Christian monk, Father Bede Griffiths, He spent most of his life as a monk in India, as a Christian monk. He had a sort of Christian Hindu ashram in India called Shantivanam. And he used to come to the United States and give talks from time to time. And he was being interviewed in the San Francisco Bay Area. And someone gave me this recording of this the interview that that he had given with the radio station. And he had this very, very posh English accent, sort of English boarding school accent. Somebody was asking him, you know, well, you're 90 years old now, and how do you relate to the aging process? And he said, well, you know, when I was younger, I had so many things to say, all these books I wrote, full of all these ideas and all this knowledge, and it was all rather a waste of time. But, you know, people appreciated that sort of thing. But now, you know, it's all gone. I can't remember anything. It's sort of lost to me, right? And so the interviewer said, so is that sort of distressing or difficult? He says, well, as long as I can remember where I've left my sandals. That's the really important thing. You know, if I just remember which door I left my sandals at, then the rest doesn't really matter, does it? Really. I thought that was a great attitude. I thought, this is a good monk, you know. He's really learnt his stuff. And you could hear just from the tone of his voice, he was being absolutely genuine. Just that he really, as long as he could find his shoes, and that the rest was gravy, you know. He didn't really mind about losing his place in the middle of a talk, or forgetting what books he'd written, or, you know, remembering people's names. You know, it's like, well, that goes. And so that, I think it's very significant and powerful teachings that we can do a lot to prepare ourselves so that we're not trying to do our homework when we're already aged and the faculties have gone, but while we still have a number of our faculties around, then we can prepare our heart, our mind for those changes. And so when we can't remember where we've left our shoes, or that who's taken my hat? Did I have my hat? Then it doesn't create suffering. We don't create a problem out of it. We don't see it as something that's a loss, but rather it's just a change in the system. So I see it's now 7 o'clock already, and I'll leave it there for today.